Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-7046, Ishmael Abdul Malik, also known as Roy Thomas, appellant, versus District of Columbia et al. Mr. Shaw for the amicus curiae, Ms. Vopel for the appellees.
Thank you, Judge Garland. My name is Stephen Goldblatt. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and I was appointed in this matter as an amicus. With the court's permission, argument today will be presented by David J. Shaw, a third-year law student at Georgetown University Law Center, who is appearing in conformity with the rules of the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. There are two issues for the court I'd like to address this morning. The first is CCA's contention that Malik failed to exhaust administrative remedies. And the second is the district court's decision to treat TransCore's second motion for summary judgment as conceded under Local Rule 7B. Failure to exhaust is an affirmative defense. In this case, in order for CCA to prevail on that defense, it must show that there was an available remedy for Malik to exhaust. On this record, CCA cannot show that there was an available remedy. When Malik first complained about his treatment on the bus ride from Ohio to Arizona at the Arizona prison, from the grievance officer to the warden, told him that there was nothing the Arizona prison can do because what he was complaining about had not been done by Arizona prison staff. If a prison lacks authority, then there is no available remedy. Moreover, CCA has not shown and cannot show on this record how Malik could have filed a grievance with either the Ohio prison, also run by CCA, or with CCA corporate headquarters.
What about the argument that even though there might have been no available remedy with the prison, he also didn't exhaust with TransCore?
Well, Your Honor, the question of exhaustion with TransCore, the district court found that there's a genuine question of material fact about whether he had or had not exhausted with TransCore. The appellee's contention that there is no genuine question of material fact simply doesn't stand because a reasonable jury could find that Malik sent the letter to TransCore. They could also find he didn't send the letter to TransCore, but this doesn't fall within the exception that this court has recognized in Arrington and in Green versus Dalton of either a conclusory statement or something that's actually internally contradictory.
So you agree then with the company that he would have had to exhaust, but your argument is just that there's an issue as to whether he did or not.
Well, Your Honor, not necessarily. I also think there's a question of whether there actually is a grievance policy at TransCore. All we know is TransCore says in litigation, in an affidavit, that they have an informal grievance policy, but there's no content to that policy so far as we can tell. They say you write us a letter, but there's nothing implying that there actually is that policy in place other than the statement that there's an informal policy. And for that matter, it's not clear what remedy TransCore could have provided Malik.
On CCA in the district, he did not raise retaliation in his grievance, correct?
That's correct.
And that's now the basis of the claim?
Well, not quite, Your Honor. In his complaint, he alleges that the guards on the bus told him he was being poorly treated because he was a D.C. prisoner, and D.C. prisoners deserve to be punished. And so we think that's a theory of liability, that's CCA's complicity in TransCore's activity. Now, we make an argument.
It seems as if that's true, that's something that should be grieved, right? Because doesn't the grievance policy explicitly refer to retaliation?
The grievance policy does refer to retaliation, yes.
And then when it carves out transfer as not being grievable, that's because transfers are not within the authority of CCA.
Yes, Your Honor. However, even if this court rejects our distinction between retaliation as a theory of liability and retaliation as a freestanding claim, and that he only has to exhaust retaliation as a freestanding claim, that still doesn't get to the question of whether the Arizona prison had the authority to address his retaliation claim, because any retaliation that he alleges would not have happened at the Arizona prison. And the Arizona prison said they had no authority to address anything that happened outside the Arizona prison. And CCA hasn't shown how Malik could have filed a grievance with the Ohio prison or with CCA corporate headquarters, where if there was retaliation, those would have been the actors that set the retaliation into motion.
The claim about retaliation, the only claim that's raised? And how would you define the different claims that are raised here?
You're right. It's a Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment based on sort of the totality of the circumstances of his treatment
on
the bus.
So, if that's the case, and if you did lose, if it were the case that you had to exhaust retaliation and didn't, you would lose only retaliation. You wouldn't lose everything else.
Yes, Your Honor.
But none of the others. How could CCA and be responsible for the what happened on the bus?
Well, Your Honor,
other than by your retaliation theory.
Well, Your Honor, TransCorp is wholly owned by CCA, so CCA might have liability as a parent corporation,
but not as the operator of the prison.
But no, not as the operator of the prison. If there's a fine line between.
Right.
That's what I was wondering. Is this a merits question that's never been reached? That is, I understood the argument suggested in your brief that CCA is the real actor here. They control the bus. They control everything else. And that may be wrong, but that's your claim, and that claim has never been heard. So that if it's the case that there was bad acting on the bus, CCA could be liable for that under your theory. Maybe wrong, but merits of which have not been decided. Is that right?
I think so, yes, Your Honor.
Now, what about the retaliation? When CCA says that there's no grievance for things relating to transfers, why is a retaliation that takes place on a bus not something for which there's still no grievance available?
Your Honor, the reason suggested is because it would have been CCA employees who set the retaliation into motion.
Right, but if your theory is that this is all one big ball of wax and the corporate form needs to be not paid attention to, I'm not saying that it's correct, but if that's your theory, and if the position of the company is that anything relating to a transfer isn't grievable, then there would be no place to make that grievance. I mean, at least with respect, I mean, I guess there are different ways to think about retaliation. You could say the retaliation begins in headquarters. That's one way to say that's where the situs of it is. But another way to think about where the situs of it is where the pain takes place, the punishment that's the consequence of retaliation.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think that's one way or the other, there isn't an available remedy, either because it happened on the bus and it's limited to the bus, or even if we would say that the retaliation is a prison condition at a CCA prison, it wasn't a prison condition at the Arizona prison, and there was no mechanism for him to grieve it elsewhere. Turning, if I can, to my second issue. In our view, the district court improperly applied Local Rule 7B. Before Malik's opposition to TransCorp's second motion for summary judgment was due, Malik filed a motion with the court indicating his belief that the court had prematurely granted summary judgment for both outstanding motions for summary judgment, and consequently he was seeking reconsideration of that. The question posed here is whether when a pro se prisoner files something indicating factual mistake about his litigation obligations within the appropriate time frame, it is appropriate for the district court to invoke Local Rule 7B and treat it as conceded. We contend it's not, because this is not a straightforward application of Local Rule 7B. Straightforward application involves a response that is either non-existent or untimely. Here, Malik had a response in within the appropriate time frame, but it didn't address the substance because he was under the very specific factual mistake that he had no obligation to respond to the second motion for summary judgment because it had already been decided. And we think that faced with these circumstances, the district court should clarify the procedural posture to pro se prisoner and give him a chance to respond before treating the motion as conceded. If I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time if possible.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll hear from counsel for the appellees.
Good morning. I'm Lori Vopel, counsel for CCA and TransCore. And I'd first like to start out by addressing the fact that a number of issues and arguments were raised for the first time by amicus, not just on appeal, but in their reply brief, which we've not yet had an opportunity to address. And I'll address those as thoroughly as I can here in oral argument. If the court is concerned with a particular issue that was not addressed previously, we'd request an opportunity to either file a supplement or to file a motion to strike.
Isn't the central issue that transfer is not grievable?
No, Your Honor. First of all, there are a number of arguments. First of all, the central...
How do you deal with that one?
The issue that the transfer is not grievable, we agree that the fact that the conditions of transport, as a general rule, are grievable with TransCore. And Mr. Malik was given the information, even though it is an informal grievance policy, was given the information on how to grieve that, to write a letter to TransCore, and he was given the address.
I meant not grievable with CCA.
It is not grievable with CCA. However, and we're not arguing here that he had to set forth a theory of liability, but he had information, facts that he included in his complaint that would have alerted CCA that as to his belief that somehow CCA officers or officials were involved in influencing his conditions of transport, that he was being punished by CCA through the conditions of transport. He included that in his complaint, as well as a number of additional claims, but didn't, and that would have been grievable as to CCA because it has to do with not just retaliation against an inmate, but also with the actions of officers, of CCA officers.
What about Mr. Shaw's point that the Arizona prison couldn't have done anything about it?
The Arizona prison, well, first of all, CCA is a corporation. We have both facilities, the Ohio facility and the Arizona facility. So clearly, if the conduct that he is complaining of, which became evident in his complaint, that he was somehow being punished during his transfer for filing lawsuits against CCA in the district, I think it clearly would have been grievable as to CCA, regardless of whether he grieved that at CACD or, you know, in Ohio. Obviously, he filed it in, we wouldn't be arguing here today, well, you know, if the influence came from our other facility, you know, then you should have grieved it there. I think clearly here he's making a very large claim that CCA is retaliating against me. The only thing he included in his grievance, which by the way was untimely to begin with, was my handcuffs and my leg shackles were too tight and the transporting officer would not let me off of the belly chain so that I could use the restroom. That in no way could put CCA on any kind of notice that any of its officers, any of its policies, any of its officials had anything to do, you know, with his conditions of transport. CCA, TransCore is a separate facility. Granted, they are a subsidiary of ours, but that's one of the new arguments raised for the first time here is this vicarious.
It's not really a new argument. It's a merits question that hasn't been resolved. That is, they have alleged that CCA is responsible. You say there was no exhaustion, and they say they don't have to exhaust on that question. They're going to hold you responsible for what happened on the bus regardless. And the district court's never reached the question of whether you're responsible for what happened on the bus or not, because the district court said that there was exhaustion.
And the district court found that there was no exhaustion because the grievances were not timely filed.
That's right, not timely filed. But if you can't grieve about this subject, it doesn't matter. The district court found both that you can't grieve and that it wasn't timely filed. But it doesn't make any sense to say that it's not timely filed if you can't grieve at all.
Your Honor, I don't think that anything in the complaint or in any way in below was there any kind of an argument as to vicarious liability. And we would like to have an opportunity to supplement our argument with that if the court is concerned about that. The argument that he made below and that he alleged in his complaint was that there is a widespread practice of CCA punishing inmates for their lawsuits. Mr. Malik in no way ever even indicated, in fact, the only citation to the fact that TransCore is a subsidiary of CCA that Amicus cited to was just a footnote in the district court's decision. So, you know, we don't believe that that was adequately alleged or raised in any way, shape, or form. He was arguing that there is this practice of punishing inmates by CCA in the district, and that he was told by an officer during his transport that he was being punished for his lawsuits by CCA during the transport. And we're saying that if he included even that one fact, we would have investigated it. But there's nothing that prohibits CCA from saying, look, if you're going to allege or complain about issues regarding your transportation, you need to submit a letter to TransCore for that.
Right, but he says he did file a letter, and the district court said there's a genuine issue of material fact on this. This only gets us to the Fox question.
Your Honor, I think that under the Johnson case that we cited in our brief, that was not a reasonable finding by the district court, that there was a question of fact. Because
if the plaintiff says that I sent the letter and the defendant says the plaintiff didn't send the letter, that the defendant automatically wins, as a judgment of law, that there's no genuine issue of material fact on that question?
Your Honor, under this court's decision in Johnson versus Washington Metro, the court held that statements by a party opposing summary judgment are generally considered true except where the plaintiff relies almost exclusively on his own self-serving testimony, unsupported by corroborating evidence, and undermined by other credible evidence, physical impossibility, or other persuasive.
Is that a question about whether a letter had been sent or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
In Johnson it was?
No. No, I apologize, Your Honor. It wasn't a question about whether a letter had been sent, but it does have to do with a question of fact is not merely created by virtue of a claimant's statement, self-serving statement that he or she did something.
How do we know the letter wasn't received?
Your Honor, first of all, this is 6 years into the litigation.
But how do we know that you don't have the letter in your files?
Your Honor, first of all, we have an affidavit, first of all.
A statement by somebody who works for your client.
For TransCore.
And that would be self-serving, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, when you combine that with the fact that the mail logs don't show that he sent
anything. How do we know the mail logs don't show?
Because we have an avowal of that.
Yes, you have a statement by an employee of your client.
That's correct.
Right. Well, that's also a self-serving statement, isn't it?
Your Honor, I think that there are two points that even take it, even setting aside all of that.
What I'm trying to say is you say that a self-serving statement by one side or the other isn't sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact or to oppose one. But all we have are self-serving statements by each side here.
Together with the circumstances that make his position incredible. Exhaustion was argued, Your Honor, from the time of the first complaint that was filed in this case way back in 2003. And Mr. Malik never, all the way through that case, through the refiled case in 2005, through discovery, never even claimed that he sent a letter to TransCorp until
like,
in response.
Sounds like a very good reason for the district court to say, well, I've weighed and on balance, I conclude that I don't find him credible and I find you credible and I make a finding of fact. But that doesn't really sound like that there are no fact issues at all.
Your Honor, I just think that, you know, under the Johnson case, that the court is able to look at the circumstances. And I do think that the fact that he never raised it, combined with his position, that he didn't receive the information to write TransCorp in the response, in the grievance officer's response, even until after he purportedly sent this letter. So I do think that those circumstances clearly show and distinguish this case from the normal case where there is, you know, arguments on both sides or claims on both sides. Here he's saying, I didn't get this information, and then suddenly in response to, and he never claims to have sent this letter, suddenly in response to the motion for judgment on the pleadings and the affidavit from TransCorp, all of a sudden here comes this letter that he supposedly sent before he even had the address or knew to write them. Your Honor, I don't think that's sufficient.
You want to take a moment and say something about the Fox issue?
Yes, Your Honor. On the Fox issue, first of all of the cases cited by the amicus, Fox, Ham, Tulis Prashad, all of those involve situations where there was no information whatsoever given to the claimant with respect to his or her duties.
I'm more interested in the question of whether reasonable for a pro se plaintiff here to be confused. I understand that there's no law directly on this point.
Right. Your Honor, I think that it is a case by case situation. Here, even if you look all the way through, and not just as to, I guess let's just start from the point at which he indicated that he was confused. At that point, his jailhouse lawyer, Mr. Hatch, filed a motion in opposition to the motion to dismiss for appointment of counsel and for a stay. Mr. Hatch, on Mr. Malik's behalf, then went through and addressed the district court's order, all of which solely dealt with the issue of exhaustion. There were no issues with respect to exhaustion raised in the motion for summary judgment.
Well, isn't he confused as of his letter of September 26th? I don't know. Doesn't that indicate confusion about whether the district court had already resolved the motion?
It does, Your Honor.
The district court grants an extension, right, a three-week extension.
That's correct.
The next day resolves, in part, the motions, and Malik... This letter of September 26 suggests confusion because he thinks that the district court, after giving an extension, then resolved the issue and actually didn't give him time to file a reply.
That's true, Your Honor. And then after it was clarified, at least by CCA, in our response of pleadings, that the judge only ruled on the motion for judgment on the pleadings or in the alternative for summary judgment, then Mr. Malik came back in his reply in support of what we'll call the motion for reconsideration and said, if I may, just briefly, he ended up stating that, I apologize if I can find this, in his reply, he said that his motion seeking an extension to file a response related to, quote, the defendant's dispositive motions, including a motion for judgment on the pleadings or an alternative for summary judgment, and, quote, the court erred in entering an order of whatsoever type, nature, and kind before September 25th. So he is aware by the time he files that reply that the court has only ruled on the motion for judgment on the pleadings.
I'm not saying why you say that. From what you just, what page is what you're reading from?
Your Honor, that is from 475 and 76 of the appendix. That's in his reply to defendant's opposition to plaintiff's motion to reconsider.
Your brief argues that what the district court resolved was a motion for judgment on pleadings, not the motion for summary judgment, right?
That's correct.
And that's why he shouldn't have been confused, that one is a motion for summary judgment and one is judgment on pleadings, right?
And he comes back, Your Honor.
Let's pause over that just
okay.
One second. When I read the order that we're talking about, which is at JA 437, that's the opinion of the district court resolving that motion, right?
Correct.
The only standard discussed in that motion is a summary judgment standard, right? In fact, it says as number one, summary judgment standard. So I'm not sure why he should have thought that this was a judgment on the pleadings. I have to say, I'm not sure why I would have thought this was judgment on the pleadings, since the district court says we're going to look at these motions, and then it sets out a standard for summary judgment. It says summary judgment is granted to the movement if it is shown. And then at the end it says, accordingly, defendant's motion will be granted in part. I'm sure I know a little bit more about civil procedure than the plaintiff, but it sounds like the district court thinks that it is ruling on a motion for summary judgment.
My point, I guess, Your Honor, is that that motion, the court did treat it as a motion for summary judgment, but the court, because it was in the alternative, but the court dealt only with the exhaustion issues, which Mr. Malik had already fully briefed. The motion for summary judgment that the court had not yet ruled on was completely on the merits of the case.
That's a question about whether it's reasonable for a pro se to be confused about that.
And my only point, Your Honor, is that by the time he filed his reply 4 months before the court issued its ruling on the motion for summary judgment on the merits, he indicated a realization that the court had only ruled on the first motion. And that's basically when he said it doesn't make any difference because the court erred in ruling on either motion. So at that point, he had an opportunity to come back and say, Your Honor, I was confused and I'm requesting leave to go ahead and file a substantive opposition to the motion for summary judgment on the merits.
It just says the court erred in entering an order of whatsoever type, nature, and kind. Is that what you mean?
And before that, that he claimed that his motion seeking an extension to file a response related to the defendant's dispositive motions, including a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which he had already responded to fully with a statement of facts. And then that the court erred in entering an order of whatsoever type, nature, and kind before September 25th. He clearly knew that by that point, Your Honor, that the judge...
I wouldn't emphasize the word clearly that strongly. It doesn't seem...
He
may have known it, but...
He did know it.
A little hard to say that he clearly knew that.
I apologize. I do think that he knew it. That does indicate that he knew it. And there was nothing stopping him over the next 4 months from asking the court to give him an opportunity to rule or to file something on the merits.
Thank you. We have your argument.
Thank you.
We reserve any time for Mr. Okay. Mr. Shaw.
Thank you. Just two points I'd like to make briefly. The first is into the question of was retaliation grievable in Arizona? And this is the wording of the memorandum that Malik received when he filed a complaint in Arizona, which was, you recently filed a grievance regarding some complaints you had with your transportation to CADC, that's the Central Arizona Detention Center, from the Northeast Ohio facility. TransCorp, not CADC staff, provided the transportation. This issue is out of this facility's control.
Below is a name, address and name of a contact for TransCorp.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. So it seems to me that based on this, the Arizona prison was disavowing any authority to address anything outside of the Arizona prison. Now, it could be that CCA does have a policy that would have allowed them to address this, but that policy isn't anywhere in the record. In fact, in the Ritchie affidavit, which outlines the grievance policy, he outlines the policy for CCA / CADC.
We don't have the actual policy in the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's their burden to show there is an affirmative defense.
All right, you want to say something about, unless Judge Kavanaugh had more on that? No. Do you want to say more about the confusion issue?
Yeah, I just want to say two brief things. First of all, I don't think that it's correct that by this October filing, he in fact knew. Because he writes in the October filing on page 476 of the appendix that, at any rate, the order was entered 19 days before a response was due. And the response he's referring to is his response to the second motion for summary judgment. So it seems to me that he still thought at this point in time that the issue, the order was premature. But the second point is the deadline for responding had expired, and the district court, in its grant of extension, was very clear that no further extension shall be granted absent extraordinary circumstances. And so I think it's quite a stretch for not only to expect the pro se prisoner to understand, to clarify to himself what the procedural posture is, but then understand he can ask for a leave to file an additional response and then file that response.
Are there further questions from the court? Mr. Shaw and Mr. Goldblatt and to the other members of the Georgetown Appellate Litigation Program, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you very much for your assistance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to counsel on the other side as well. Cases be taken under submission.